Muslims worldwide getting into a festive mood as the Hajj pilgrimage culminates with Eid al-Adha. Anti-government protests rock Sri Lanka. The president flees just in time to avoid any angry mob overrunning his residence. Also coming up, Tunisia's president unveils an amended version of a highly criticized constitution ahead of a referendum later this month. Hello and welcome. You're watching World News from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Muslims in many countries around the world are celebrating Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, that marks the end of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. The exact date of Eid al-Adha depends on the lunar sightings and varies by country. Thousands of Palestinians perform the Eid prayers at Al-Aqsa Mosque in Quds, and Afghans also celebrated the occasion with prayers in mosques nationwide. Muslims in other regional countries, including Jordan, Egypt, Oman, Kazakhstan, and Turkey, have celebrated the event too, slaughtering an animal as part of the ceremonies to mark Eid al-Adha, and that is done in remembrance of Prophet Abraham's readiness to sacrifice his son in obedience to God. Iran and many countries elsewhere in the world, including in Asia and Africa, will mark Eid al-Adha on Sunday. Also, Muslims performing Hajj rituals in the Saudi city of Mecca are celebrating Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, that marks the culmination of the annual pilgrimage. Pilgrims are now performing the stoning of the devil, a ceremony symbolizing complete obedience to God. They do that at the tent city of Mina, close to Mecca, after staying the night there. The pilgrims will then slaughter an animal. After that, they will go to the Grand Mosque in Mecca to perform a final tawaf, or circling around the Kaaba. This year's Hajj pilgrimage is the biggest since the COVID pandemic began. Some 1 million Muslims, including 850,000 from outside Saudi Arabia, are taking part. Hajj is one of the largest annual religious gatherings in the world. Also, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a message on the annual event of the Hajj pilgrimage calling for unity among Muslims. The leader said the enemies have long strived to sow divisions and undermine spirituality among Muslims. Ayatollah Khamenei, however, said that the Islamic world is today ready to foil these plots. He said this is due to resistance and the fact that Muslims are more aware of the grand value of their religion. Ayatollah Khamenei said there is a large number of young people in Islamic countries who are energetic and highly motivated. He termed those youth, quote, valuable assets in shaping the future of the Muslim world. Also, in his message, the leader said that the Islamic Republic is a good example of how Islamic sovereignty, together with people's vote, can form the principles of governance in a country. The leader hailed what he called stability, independence, and progress, and the honor of the Islamic Republic as a meaningful phenomenon that can attract the thoughts of every conscious Muslim. Political commentator Sayyid Mohsin Abbas joined us earlier to give us his thoughts. He says that Hajj is a symbol of equality and stance against oppression.
The problems that Muslims face and the problems by extension the West faces, and what's going on in West Asia at the moment in terms of the oppression of Yemen, the oppression of the likes of the Palestinians, the oppression of Afghanistan, you know, all across that region, it's littered with the oppression of Zionists and the imperialists. For the Saudis to reject that obviously is a political move because they're hand in glove with that very oppression. They're the ones fighting in Yemen. They're the ones funding a lot of the terrorism around that region. They're the ones who give the Americans and the Zionists a foothold in the region. And they're the ones who spread religious ideologies which sectarianize and divide. Well, the Hajj goes against the vein of all of that. And, you know, the enemies, of course, who try to weaken Islam's spirituality, who are weakening even Westerners themselves in terms of their morality and spirituality, they have this neoliberal material ideology, which again, the Hajj rejects. You can see the two pieces of cloth which Muslims wear at the Hajj, the simplicity of it, the beauty of it, and the circumambulation and the Kaaba all represent this kind of lack of materialism and this kind of alternative worldview. And I think that's what scares certainly the Zionist Western Empire, which is the primary problem creator across the globe today. And that's what actually empowers the resistance axis.
Anger boiling up in Sri Lanka over the worst economic crisis in decades. Earlier today, thousands of protesters stormed the president's official residence in the capital, Colombo. Hundreds packed into rooms and corridors, shouting slogans against the president, and of course he was reportedly removed from the official premises on Friday ahead of the protests at the weekend. People traveled to Colombo from other parts of Sri Lanka to join the protests in the city. People want the president to step down, blaming his government for the economic hardships that they are facing. Sri Lanka has been crippled by the shortage of foreign exchange that has left it struggling to pay for fuel, food, and medicine. The island nation has sought an International Monetary Fund bailout to secure funds for essential commodities. Jehan Pereira is the chief of Sri Lanka's National Peace Council. He attended the Colombo protests earlier today and then spoke to us about the ongoing rallies and the people's demands for change in their country.
The mood is quite jubilant at this time, that as you would have seen footage of people going into the president's house and occupying it. They are taking a swim. They're touring it. Hopefully they will not vandalize it. I'm very hopeful that that will not happen. But they have been able to breach that. And what this means is that it shows that the government is unable to resist the people's protest. And I'm hopeful. Now, there is no constitutional way to force the president out. There's a very long process of impeachment. But also the people want the parliament also. They want the government in its entirety to go. The president plus the government, which is dominated by the president's party, they want them to go. And I have a feeling that that is going to happen now. And what we are moving towards is an all-party government, a small all-party government. Maybe it excludes the present the ruling family and the ministers of this present government, but it's going to be a small all-party government for a temporary period to try and get over the hump.
Tunisian President Kais Saied has amended a draft constitution after the original version drew criticism over the powers that it gave the head of state. The amended draft makes changes to two articles, including the one about rights and freedoms. Those articles have been criticized for paving the way for a dictatorial regime. President Saied published the amended version late on Friday, saying that he aimed to avoid confusion. Still, the new version is believed to retain a broad range of powers for the head of state. The new constitution will be put to a referendum this month and is a main part of Saied's plan to remake Tunisia's politics. Last year, he sacked the government and dissolved parliament, a move seen by his critics as a coup against democracy. People in Japan mourn the death of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe a day after he was shot dead in the western city of Nara. Mourners visited the scene of Abe's assassination, putting flowers there to show respect for him. Earlier today, a hearse carrying Abe's body arrived in his residence in the capital, Tokyo. Abe was the longest-serving prime minister of Japan. He was shot during an election campaign rally ahead of the Sunday upper house vote and later died in hospital. The suspect is in custody and has confessed to assassinating Abe His motivation? Well, he believes that Abe was linked to an unspecified group. The killing sent shockwaves across Japan and the world, and Iran has called it a terror attack and has strongly condemned it. Japanese political analyst Takeshita says gun violence is very rare in Japan, and that is why the attack on Abe is so shocking.
In Japan, we don't have gun crimes, period. I mean, last year, according to the police, there's been only one death by, you know, gun in Japan. A year before that, only four. And most of it is due to the mobs. So this isn't our, you know, daily incident that we face. And to have that to Mr. Abe, who has served this country the longest than anybody else, over 2,880 days, and to who also created a lot of positive legends, like, you know, Abenomics, for example. You know, to have him being shot in middle of the street while he's making a speech is, firstly, totally unacceptable, and also, secondly, very devastating. Again, this is Japan. It's not United States, where you know, often find people holding guns. Again, only one death last year on gun crimes in Japan. So I would have imagined that, you know, most of the SBs didn't think, you know, that anybody would have a gun shooting at him. Possibly, you know, knives or machetes, as you just pointed out earlier, but certainly not guns.
The cross-border humanitarian aid to Syria's Idlib is in a state of limbo after Russia and Western countries vote down each other's resolutions in the UN Security Council. The Western text would have extended the aid by 1 year without asking Damascus. Moscow, however, proposed a six-month extension. It said that the Western resolution ignored the sovereignty of Damascus. On the other hand, the U.S. accused Moscow of putting its own political interests above humanitarian needs of Syrian people. The current authorization for the aid deliveries expires on Sunday. The shipments were being made from Turkey into the northwestern Syrian province of Idlib since 2014. The province is partially held by the anti-Damascus groups. Russia says that any assistance to them would require the authorization of Damascus. While Iran is in the midst of the JCPOA revival talks, the United States has once again gone against the spirit of the talks by imposing fresh sanctions on Iran's oil and petrochemical sector. Meanwhile, Iran has warned the regional countries against normalizing ties with the Israeli regime, particularly when it comes to teaming up in the face of what is claimed to be, quote, threats from Iran.
Amid ongoing diplomatic efforts to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the U.S. has introduced fresh sanctions against Iran. Washington claims the measures target an international network of individuals and entities that allegedly facilitated the sale of Iranian petroleum and petrochemical products to East Asia. The move comes ahead of President Biden's visit to the region next week. Last week, Iran held high-stake diplomatic talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, to restore the JCPOA, with the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora, shuttling between Iran's top negotiator, Ali Bagherikani, and Robert Malley, the U.S. special envoy for Iran. Following the talks, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, rejected claims made by U.S. officials about new demands raised by the Iranian delegation in the Doha talks, saying the Islamic Republic's requests are in line with the 2015 accord. He said, contrary to U.S. media claims, Tehran put forward no excessive demands that goes beyond the framework of the JCPOA. Amir Abdollahian's remarks came in response to U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley, who claimed that Tehran came up with new demands at the Doha talks. The U.S. State Department spokesman, Ned Price, echoed Malley's remarks, claiming that Iran has consistently introduced extraneous demands, demands that, or issues that, go beyond the four walls of the JCPOA.
The United States and Israel have resorted to scaremongering against Iran among regional countries by focusing on the Islamic Republic's nuclear energy program, regional influence, and military might. It is now reported that U.S. President Joe Biden will use his upcoming visit to the region to push for a regional, quote, security pact between the Persian Gulf countries and Israel in order to counter Iran's, quote, malign activities.
Iran is pursuing the JCPOA talks, while Israel has been sounding the alarm about Iran, its regional influence, and its alleged efforts of weaponizing its nuclear program.
And Israel is far from wanting the interests of the countries of the region. On the other hand, we see that the countries in the region like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, they're talking to each other, they're meeting in Baghdad. They've met several times in Arab and Middle Eastern capitals. So they are capable of sorting out their problems. And therefore, any relationship with Israel would be detrimental and against the interest of the countries of the Middle East.
Meanwhile, a top Iranian security official has warned against forming alliances with Israel, saying that such moves endanger the security of the region. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, says that any alliance with the Israeli regime, even of a non-security and non-military nature, will pose serious threats to the stability and security of the Middle East region. Shamkhani made the remarks in a meeting with the visiting Qatari Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, in Tehran. He underlined the emphasis on neighboring countries in the Islamic Republic's foreign policy, asserting that Tehran's coherent policy towards its neighbors is to expand all-out and strategic relations on the principle of good neighborliness. Separately, Shamkhani warned that the Islamic Republic opposes any move that changes regional geopolitics. This was in reference to a so-called Arab NATO, plan that was a non-starter when it was introduced by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. This military regional alliance was due to Israel and the U.S. sounding the alarm over the perceived threat coming from Iran.
The Iranophobia is something very natural to happen in the West because it is one of the U.S. tools against a country like Iran, like Russia, who refused to submit to the U.S. hegemony.
Iran has rejected such a notion and has said that through regional cooperation, security can be established. Iran believes that Israel and the presence of foreign forces are the source of instability.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader's speech to Hajj officials. The following is part of the speech delivered on May the 23rd, 2012, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of Hajj affairs. There are two sides to what the sinful hands of the enemies did in America and insulted the Holy Prophet of Allah. On the one hand, what they did is indicative of the depth of the grudge that the enemies and the arrogant powers bear against the Prophet of Mercy, the Prophet of Honor, the Prophet of Dignity. the embodiment of the most noble and valuable human virtues throughout history and in the entire creation. It shows the depth of their hostility towards the Holy Prophet. On the other hand, their politicians adopt positions which are indistinguishable from hostile positions. This is one side of the issue, which proved very beneficial to the world of Islam. Even the most skeptical people and communities realized who the main sides of the confrontation are. They realized that the confrontation is between the camp of truth and the camp of falsehood.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It became clear that the confrontation is centered around the essence of Islam, around the essence of the seal of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. This event was caused by the enemies, but it was the world of Islam that benefited from it. This was because the world of Islam identified the enemy and the reason behind his enmity. The world of Islam realized the difference between truth and falsehood. These are the main issues today. The rest of what the arrogant powers of the world say against Muslim nations are secondary issues. They are just lies and pretexts. It became clear what the essence of the issue is. This is one side of the issue. The other side of the issue is the great movement which was carried out by Muslims. Notice what is happening today in the world of Islam. Notice how Muslim people are reacting. The majority of them have not even watched the film. They only know that it insults the Holy Prophet. Yet, notice how the world of Islam is reacting. Islamic countries and peoples step into the arena without being incited to take action. With all their heart and soul, they express their heartfelt love and respect for the Holy Prophet. This is very valuable. What happened was amazing.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Tunisia has been in a deep political crisis that has aggravated the country's economic conditions since President Kais Saied ousted the government, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority last year. Now, the crisis worsened when the president announced in March this year that he was dissolving the parliament. Hello, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. In the first part of our program today, we are focusing on the political crisis unfolding in Tunisia following drastic measures taken by the president to dissolve the elected parliament and dismiss scores of judges. We are asking, what direction will this North African country take after a referendum is held later this month? In the second part of our show today, we are discussing the continued impact of the Ukraine conflict in Africa and how the Ukrainian president was recently snubbed by African leaders.
Tunisia in political turmoil. In July 2021, President Kais Saied dismissed the prime minister and suspended parliament. The Tunisian president said at the time that his decision was meant to save Tunisia, the state, and the Tunisian people. In the midst of growing public anger and protests against the government's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, President Saied's decision was welcomed by many Tunisians tired of a frequently deadlocked post-revolutionary democracy. However, in a pointer to a polarized country, thousands of Tunisians opposed to the move have continued to hold demonstrations across the country.
As part of his reform agenda, President Saied has organized a referendum on a new constitution that his opponents claim will cement his hold on power. Sadouk Belaid, coordinator of the National Consultative Commission for a New Republic, charged with drafting the new document, speaks here after presenting the draft constitution to President Saied.
The conditions for drafting the constitution were difficult because of the short time we had at our disposal. But we managed, thanks to everyone's efforts, to submit this first version of the constitution. We hope that this will satisfy the president.
Now, to discuss the unfolding situation in Tunisia, we contacted Hamdi, the editor-in-chief of the International Interest. Now, Tunisians are protesting against a constitutional referendum called by President Saied. This draft constitution has been produced through a national dialogue that excluded the main opposition forces and was boycotted by the powerful UGTT Trade Union Confederation. Now, can it bring the desired results of political stability and progress in Tunisia?
I think it's important to remember or stress that the constitution that was overthrown by Kais Saied, the 2014 constitution, was negotiated by an elected parliament for over 3 years, clause by clause. It was carefully negotiated, carefully drafted, carefully discussed, carefully debated, and then it was presented in 2014. Kais Saied's constitution, however, has been drawn up in less than 30 days by a select group of individuals specifically appointed by Kais Saied without the input of the experts who refused to participate in his commission to draft the constitution, and without the input of the opposition political parties, or indeed any political party that has been elected by the Tunisian people. In other words, it's a unilaterally written constitution in accordance with the desires of Kais Saied, and therefore this is an imposition of a constitution as opposed to a democratic constitution, and therefore it's very unlikely that it's going to lead to this political stability that Kais Saied promises, especially given that even the trade unions who support the coup have announced that they are not going to support his constitution or support his roadmap.
The first article of Tunisia's 2014 constitution and its 1959 predecessor defined the country as a free, independent, and sovereign state. Islam is its religion and Arabic is its language. However, Tunisian President Kais Saied now says that the draft constitution to be put to a referendum on July 25 will not enshrine Islam as the religion of the state. What led to this decision and what is the significance of this announcement, especially considering that Ennahda, an Islamic party, is one of the most popular parties in the country?
I think it's important to remember one thing. The first is that Tunisia has often wrestled with the Islamic identity and has often wrestled with the Islamic identity in a bid to try to win international support. Kais Saied is removing Islam from the constitution in contradiction to what he said in 2014 when he said that this is a clause that should be supported. Kais Saied has removed this clause in the constitution in a bid to present his own coup as progressive to an international community that is not comfortable with his coup.
President Saied also dismissed 57 judges on June 1st, accusing them of corruption and protecting terrorists. The Tunisian Judges Association has rejected the charges, saying they are mostly politically motivated. Analysts believe the judges have been removed for failing to toe the president's line.
I think it's important to remember that since Kais Saied seized power for himself on the 25th of July 2021, almost a year ago. He's been dragging his political opponents before the courts and before military courts in a bid to try to convict them on charges of corruption. The idea here is that if Saeed can convict his political opponents of corruption, then he can, by extension, convict the democratic process that he's overthrown of corruption. He can argue and say that I've overthrown a corrupt democratic process, and the proof is that these political opponents who have been elected are guilty of corruption.
Recently, Tunisia's main trade union confederation, UGTT, called up to 3 million public sector workers to strike, halting work at 159 state agencies and public companies to demand concessions on salaries and reforms. Now, UGTT chief Noureddine Tebboubi has also blamed the government for not including this powerful union in national dialogue. Now, what is the impact of the strike, and will the government respond positively to the workers' demands?
I think it's important to stress that the trade union strike against Qais Saeed is not because of the conditions of the workers. It's not about workers' pay, even though that's what the trade unions claim it is about. Instead, it's about this power struggle that's unfolding between the trade unions and Qais Saeed. The trade unions wholeheartedly backed Qais Saeed's coup, but they believe that Qais Saeed would be subservient to them, that they would be able to control Qais Saeed, they would be able to influence Qais Saeed, and they would be able to impose their own desire on the process of the coup in a manner similar to what they did with the National Dialogue in 2013-2014. The problem, however, for the trade unions is that Qais Saeed has monopolized power. He refuses to share power. He refuses to engage with the trade unions. The problem the trade unions have is that they don't want this coup to fall because they don't want the Islamists to come back to power. The leftist trade unions have a rabid hatred for the Islamists and are very frustrated that the Islamists keep winning in the democratic elections. So they want this coup to stay. The problem, however, is that Saeed is not engaging them, and they are worried about going hard against Saeed because they don't want this coup to topple.
The head UGTT trade union has rejected International Monetary Fund conditions for a new loan to bail out Tunisia's struggling economy and has questioned the government's authority to negotiate. President Saeed has made concessions demanded by the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, cutting subsidies and wages.
An economist says if the government fails to convince the population, then it will not be able to implement economic reforms.
The negotiations with the IMF will take place amid an unprecedented economic crisis in Tunisia. Therefore, the authorities will make many sacrifices. The government needs to convince the population that the reforms are necessary. Otherwise, it will not be able to implement any change or reform.
Now, why is the president obeying these IMF conditions at the expense of the welfare of the people?
I think when it comes to the negotiations regarding the IMF, it's important to remember that Tunisia is in a very dire economic situation that is spiraling out of control and spiraling into ever-increasing crises and woes for the ordinary Tunisian. The reason that the Tunisians protested against the democratic transition or protested against parliament, the reason why many Tunisians are not interested in seeing parliament return, which is something that has helped Qais Saeed, is because they believe that the parliament has not delivered on the aspirations of the Arab Spring, which were rooted in economic development. They wanted better jobs. They wanted the alleviation of poverty. They wanted equal opportunities. They wanted a better standard of living. None of that has been delivered. And Qais Saeed is aware that as in 2016-2017, Youssef Shahid, the prime minister then, also had very high poll ratings when he first came to power and he was seen as combating corruption. But Youssef Shahid's failure to tackle the economy meant that people very quickly turned against him.
Amid the political crisis in Tunisia, the government recently announced that it had launched an investigation of an attempt to assassinate President Qais Saeed. Justice Minister Hasna Ben Saliman told a local radio that she approved the Court of Appeals prosecutor investigating the attempt, but gave no further details.
Now, our last question. Where is Tunisia heading in the next months and years amid the political turmoil and economic crisis?
I think the reality is that the international community appears to be approaching Qais Saeed's coup as with the approach that is similar to that with which they approached the coup in Egypt when Sisi overthrew the democratically elected president. They are aware they are unable to get enough people to the streets to demand the return of parliament. And they've also changed tactic into recognizing the suspension of parliament, but asking for an inclusive national dialogue, essentially offering a concession to recognize Saeed's emergency measures in exchange for being included in the political process. And I think this is the tragedy of what is unfolding in Tunisia, in that at this moment in time, because of the dire economic situation, there's a lack of appreciation as to the importance of the democratic transition, and more a focus on who can deal with the economic crisis, who can deal, whether it's democracy or dictatorship, just as long as they can deal with the economic crisis. And I think this apathy towards the democratic process is what benefits Kais Saied.
Well, there you have it. The dire economic situation in Tunisia has created apathy towards the democratic process in the country. We'd like to thank our guest Sami Hamdi for his incisive analysis, and we now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the continuing impact of the Ukraine conflict in Africa and how the Ukrainian president was recently snubbed by African leaders. Stay with us.
African leaders snub Ukrainian president.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
On the 20th of June, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the African Union during a virtual meeting in which only four heads of state from the continent took part.
According to reports, all the heads of state of the continent were invited. But apart from the African Union chairman, President Macky Sall of Senegal, only three of them participated from their respective presidential offices: Alassane Ouattara of Ivory Coast, Mohamed El Menfi, President of the Libyan Council, and Denis Sassou Nguesso of Congo. In his belated address, the Ukrainian president tried to convince the few African leaders listening to him that the conflict in his country was the reason for the sharp increase in food prices.
This war may seem very distant to you and your countries, but catastrophically rising food prices have already brought it home to millions of African families.
Many in Africa hold the view that the conflict in Ukraine was imposed by Western powers. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has openly blamed the US-led NATO military alliance for the war in Ukraine and said he will resist calls to condemn Russia.
For us, this is an important development. Whilst other people scream and shout, we want to focus on the outcome, the positive outcome of those negotiations and that mediation process. That is what is important.
For more on the conflict in Ukraine and its impact on Africa, we contacted Tshepo Magema, a former member of South African Parliament. Now, only four presidents were interested in holding a video conference with the Ukrainian president, while he had requested to address all African leaders after months of intense lobbying. Now, why did African leaders decide to snub Zelensky?
There is a general feeling both amongst the population of the African continent and the leadership that this is a war that should not have happened. It is a war that could have been prevented, but for the hubris and arrogance of Western leaders, in particular the EU and the US. And so it led us and left us in this situation. And so there is that sense that, look, we don't want to be drawn into what is essentially a US/EU/NATO war. against Russia. And so there is that understanding that Russia had to act in one way or the other.
When the Ukrainian president was given a chance to address African Union leaders, he claimed that Africa is in reality a hostage of Russia's war. Let's listen in.
Africa is actually taken hostage, hostage of those who started the war against our state.
Remarks by the Ukrainian president have been termed by many as arrogant and typical of Europe's condescending attitudes towards Africa. Now, Mr. Magema, what's your take on these remarks by the Ukrainian president?
Look, generally as Africans, we take umbrage, at such arrogance for especially Westerners to want to tell us what our state is, what our conditions are. We are very clear, we are nobody's hostage. And indeed, the AU has taken such a position in general in terms of its attitude that we are nobody's hostage. We are indeed, there are some challenges that arise out of this thing, but we reject the notion, that we are hostage as if, as Africans, we do not have agency to act. And so it's actually, we see it as an affront to African agency to really, engage with the world and do business and pursue our own interests, as Africans. So, but then again, it is that kind of racist arrogance that we have, become accustomed to, and notwithstanding the fact that we've been rejecting it for all the centuries of colonialism since we got into contact with Western civilization. So in that sense, that statement means nothing to us. We don't see ourselves as hostages.
Well, the European Union has aggressively pursued sanctions and severing of economic ties in a bid to punish Russia for its military operations in Ukraine, a strategy that has attracted widespread criticism.
South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has said that bystander countries were suffering due to sanctions against Russia.
Now, the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia are going to have and are having an overarching impact. Even those countries that are either bystanders or not part of the conflict are also going to suffer from the sanctions that have been imposed against Russia.
After imposing sanctions, Western countries are accusing Russia of being behind a worsening food shortage in Africa. Is it agreeable to claim that Russia is the main reason behind the so-called food crisis in Africa?
It seems to me that, a food crisis in Africa, put in those terms, is really being used as a beating stick, a stick to beat Russia with, to say, but Russia, you are responsible for a food crisis in Africa, because Africa, of course, is one of those vulnerable parts of the world where we have famines and food crises breaking out every, now and then, every decade or two or so. And so in that sense, Africa, the crisis is not as deep, at least as some would suggest.
Since the beginning of the conflict between Ukraine and Russia, people in Africa condemn the double standards of treatment of African nationals. Many Africans were physically attacked by Ukrainian police and endured maltreatment from the country's authorities, including being left stranded and helpless in freezing temperatures. An African student speaks after escaping a harrowing experience in Ukraine.
I remember they punched a certain black guy, a policeman in Ukraine, punched a certain black guy for nothing. He was shocked for nothing. Yes, so like I said earlier on, they consider white people before considering black people.
Volodymyr Zelensky said in February that any African students who leave Ukraine will not be welcome there once the war is over. Africans will certainly never forget how they experienced racism while trying to escape the conflict in Ukraine.
Now, regardless of whether the conflict in Ukraine is the source of the food crisis in Africa or not, many agree that the continent needs to end dependence on food imports. The president of the Africa Development Bank, Akinwumi Adesina, says the bank is funding agricultural projects in the continent to end dependency on imports.
We have a $1.5 billion facility. It's not just the money. We have the systems in place across Africa, and that facility will allow African countries to produce 38 million metric tons of food. I told you we'll lose 30 million metric tons of food from Russia, to produce 38 million metric tons of food. But that food will be broken down into what we're actually dealing with. There will be 11 million metric tons that will be wheat. There will be 18 million metric tons that will be maize. There will be 6 million metric tons that will be rice. 2.5 million metric tons that will be soybeans.
Now, what can African countries learn from the conflict in Ukraine, especially in terms of reviving agriculture and rebuilding regional sovereign grain reserves to avoid the current situation?
There's about 70% of the world's available arable land cannot ensure its food security. And so it's crucial that, African leaders in earnest begin to work on practical projects, bankable projects that will ensure, grain and wheat and fertilizer production on the continent. But that also, I must add, will require that we push the IMF and World Bank, who have, in fact, in many ways deindustrialized our agricultural sector and made it less profitable for African countries to grow their own food, vis-a-vis the importation of cheap products from abroad. And so that is the strategic task that face our continent and its leaders. And there needs to be really a lot of work. I mean, South Africa is doing well in that regard. It's a net exporter. That work must still continue and be expanded.
Well, indeed, Africa needs to ensure self-reliance in food security, and this requires dedicated leadership. We'd like to thank our guest, Isetho Magama, a former member of South African Parliament, for his insight today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot, and goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Welcome to Arab English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode, and you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, where you could get the answers to all your questions. Well, today we have Dr. Karimi, scholar of religious studies, who will help us with the answers. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Dr. Karimi.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Well, as the ritual for this program, we will ask you some questions and then you are going to help us with the answers.
Sure.
So, there's been this question that is asking about backbiting. We know that in our holy book of Quran, we have this fact that adultery, considering the deadly sins that are mentioned in all the religions, adultery is bigger than even murdering other people. As in considering the fact that the greatness of a sin, the deadly sins, if we consider them, then adultery is even considered to be worse than murdering other people. Now, in our holy book, we have that backbiting is even worse than adultery. So how shall these things come together? How do we justify these three things?
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, at least when it comes to the Noble Book of Quran, we cannot find any verse referring to this claim that adultery is greater than murder or murder is greater than the adultery. What you mentioned regarding backbiting being worse than adultery is not mentioned in the Quran, but we have some narrations mm-hmm. regarding this. So this is the fact that there
so
are
so we have no fact considering saying that adultery is worse than a murdering.
No. And at least there is no verse in the Quran.
But we have narrations.
No, not regarding this point too. Mm-hmm. I will come to this point, which, I mean,
so from where
sin
this comes
is greater.
Out?
I'm not sure. We need to ask the one who has sent the question. But I will come to that because, I mean, we have some different narrations when it comes to telling us which sin is greater than the mm-hmm. other. I will discuss that. What we have in the Noble Book of Quran regarding backbiting is the famous verse of chapter Hujurat, verse 12, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala calls backbiting as being like eating the flesh of your dead brother. أَيُحِبُّ أَحَدُكُمْ يَأْكُلَ لَحْمَ أَخِيهِ مَيْتًا فَكَرِهْتُمُهُ. Will any of you love to eat the flesh of his dead brother? You will hate it. But now, when it comes to the narrations, so the question is about the greatness of the sins, which one is greater than the other in terms of...
Do we have such a concept?
Yeah. To some extent, we have this concept, and that is, first of all, we have the concept of the minor sins and the major sins. Mm-hmm. So, from one dimension, we can, based on the narrations, we can divide the sins into two categories, the major sins and the minor sins. This is for sure. But now the point is that what is the definition of the minor sin and that of the major sin? And there are some differences of viewpoints, I mean, when it comes to the, at least, Shia scholars. But there is no doubt about the fact that we have minor sins and major sins, and this can be understood from the Noble Book of Quran. So there is no doubt about that. Although some mystics say that you cannot call any sin as minor, because at the end of the day, you are disobeying God, so it's a major sin. Anyway.
Because a simple lie may turn into a great murder.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So there is no...
No, what is mentioned by the mystics is that even a very, I mean, a small sin, it is an act of obedience against your creator. So you cannot call it a minor sin. At the end of the day, you are disobeying God.
Exactly.
So from that perspective, there is no concept of minor sin. So this is a mystical definition and understanding of the word. But when it comes to the verses of the Quran, this is a true conclusion from the verses, that there are minor sins and major sins. For example, chapter Nisa, verse 31 reads, أَعْضُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ إِن تَجْتَنِبُوا كَبَائِرَ مَا تُنْهَوْنَ عَنْهِ. If you avoid the major sins that you are forbidden, نُكَفِّرْ عَنْكُمْ سَيِّئَاتِكُمْ, then we will forgive your سَيِّئَات, which according to many scholars refer to minor sins. So here we have كَبَائِر, major ones, and سَيِّئَات, the minor sins. Also in chapter Shura, verse 37, we have the concept of كَبَائِرَ الْإِثْمِ وَالْفَوَاحِشِ, the major sins and indecencies. When it comes to the narrations, there are many narrations referring to this fact that we have major sins and minor sins. In Al-Kafi by Sheikh Kunini, there is a chapter called Bab al-Kaba'ir, a section on major sins, and there are 24 narrations in this regard. But what is the criterion, or what are the criteria for calling a sin a major sin and the other sins the minor ones? There are a couple of criteria mentioned by these scholars. For example, one criterion is that if, for a sin, there is a punishment mentioned in the Quran, specifically in the Quran or in the narrations, that is a major sin. For example, we have it for lying or for backbiting. There is a specific punishment mentioned for it. This is one criterion.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The other one is that we know for sure, for example, that backbiting is a major sin because of the verses and narrations. And then the other narration is telling us that another sin is greater than that sin, which is for sure the major sin. So that sin should also be called the major sin. The other point is repetition of minor sins. A sin might be minor, but if you repeat that, then it turns into a major sin. According to another criterion, some scholars believe that ta'zir, which is a specific kind of punishment for the sins, is a kind of indication for that sin being a major one. Now, what are the number of the major sins? There are different numbers mentioned in the narrations, like we have some narrations referring to 7 sins, 19, 10, 20, 31, 34, and 40. So, my first point is that, first of all, there is no doubt about the fact that we have minor sins.